You have to be doing something in a new way, in a novel way. You have to be codifying those ideas in a way that other people can execute on them. Again, if I just do something all by myself, that's great for me, but that is not being a leader in the market. So at its most basic definition, thought leader is have thoughts, be a leader.
This is Erin Balsa from House of Bold, and you're listening to the Notorious Thought Leader podcast. More and more B2B marketers are talking about thought leadership. Some companies are even renaming their blog the Thought Leadership Blog. But what does it actually mean to be a thought leader? And how are top B2B marketers using thought leadership to generate demand? That's what we're here to find out.
My guest today is Ashley Foss, who's the Director of Integrated Product Marketing at Atlassian. And the reason I wanted to have Ashley here as my first guest for this podcast is because when I think about thought leadership, I think Ashley has it going on for two reasons. First, you know, she is very involved in thought leadership at Atlassian, A, and B, she's a thought leader herself. She has created different frameworks and models for thinking about thought leadership, and she's been asked to speak at some of the best top tier conferences. For example, I know you were speaking at Inbound about thought leadership. So I wanted to have her on today to talk a bit about the burning question that's top of mind for me, and I know a lot of other people: WTF is thought leadership? So Ashley, first question to you, what the fuck is thought leadership?
Yes, I got very excited about this title because I think that's the most honest way to ask this question, right? Most people do it in this delicate manner where they're like, oh yes, we need to pontificate about the things. So I think that thought leadership, you know, if we map it back to my four pillars, it's about credibility. It's about having a profile, which is really around that external influence piece. It's about being prolific. So it's not just one time you had one smart idea. It's how are you shaping the conversation? How are you driving it forward? And then it's about strong depth of ideas. So where a lot of people get confused is they think it's about selling a product or service, or it's about selling a brand or selling an organization. That's not thought leadership, that's sales. And we need quality content in sales as well. But that depth of ideas piece, you have to be doing something in a new way, in a novel way. You have to be codifying those ideas in a way that other people can execute on them. Again, if I just do something all by myself, that's great for me, but that is not being a leader in the market. So at its most basic definition, thought leader is have thoughts, be a leader. Right? It's not sales. It's not brand. It's not being famous. It really is that combination of, you know, smart, deep ideas that can help shape and change someone's organization or execution or mindset, and then sharing those in a way that they can actually consume them and put them into practice.
So when you say, you know, original ideas, to me, that seems like the hardest maybe way to become a thought leader. Would you say that with the people you work with who want to become thought leaders, where do they struggle the most in the four pillars? Is it coming up with the original ideas? Or do you feel like they struggle more to find time to be prolific and to be creating all different types of content and all different channels?
I would say most of the folks that I work with struggle to be prolific. And I think that in large part, it's because I work with a lot of technical folks. They actually are articulate. They're smart. They create a lot of internal content on Slack. Obviously, at Atlassian, we have a very strong internal blogging culture. So the stuff that I see internally in our Confluence instance is so smart. And numerous times I'm like, can we share this externally? Like, what of this needs to be, you know, is proprietary such that we wouldn't want to share it, or is not quite baked enough so that we're ready to say, hey, this is our official point of view, but it's super smart. And so I think that there's a couple of things. There's the externalizing it from a prolific standpoint, but there's also breaking it up into digestible points. So again, some of the stuff I see on Confluence, maybe 1,000, 3,000, 5,000 words, and it links to five other pages, and it links to this framework, and it links to this matrix. All of that content is going to be really difficult for somebody to digest in a single sitting. And again, the fact that it's linked to all of these other internal pages, the authors know that this is not something that can be consumed in one small, you know, sitting. but they often struggle to break it up into a whole journey that people can go up, down, sideways. You know, again, if you look at the stuff that I post on LinkedIn, most of it is what I would call probably mid-form content. You know, I do like long updates. I frequently run out of characters on LinkedIn, especially in comments, but I'm able to link to longer form content where I'm able to string together a couple of different posts so that you can start to address that content at different depths. So that would be, I think, the biggest thing is being prolific, in large part because they're not as fluent in the skill of breaking that content up into, you know, a journey that has multiple entrances and exits and crosslinks and off ramps and on ramps.
That's really interesting you said that, because when I was at my last job, I would look at, you know, these documentations, things we were presenting at all company meetings and thinking, this is brilliant. Somebody spent probably 4 to 6 hours to put this deck together. This is stuff that our audience would die for. And I started taking it, blogging about it, turning into like open public templates because it wasn't proprietary stuff. So I think that's a really key takeaway for anyone listening. You have all of this amazing thought leadership from the people that already don't struggle with the unique ideas and frameworks. They have them, they're using them every day internally. So that right there is your first key to getting good original ideas that you can help to get out there. And the thing with prolificness, tell me what you think about this, Ashley. I think that people struggle because they think they're the ones that have to do the work. And then there are people like you and I and everyone else listening that's a marketer that's like, no, 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 we can help you. So what would you say to a marketer listening who doesn't quite know how to help, right? So they're wanting to help. They have these really brilliant, you know, people internally, whether they are individual contributors who have amazing, unique ideas, whether these are senior leaders. What's the kind of easiest way for them to capture that brilliance and capture those ideas in a form that can help the company grow?
The biggest thing I would say is record everything. So if somebody gives a talk, whether that's internally or externally, record it, get the transcript of it. You can then start to turn that into a series of posts or one big long form, you know, blog post or contributed article. If somebody does a podcast, great. Listen to the podcast, rip it, potentially see if there's any big quotes or, you know, bite-sized sound bites that you could put into a slide deck. And then that turns into a carousel on LinkedIn. So I think that just breaking out of the mindset that each thing belongs in the original medium that it was shared in, record it all and take that holistic approach to say, you know, you can record an hour-long presentation can turn into multiple blog posts, a whole LinkedIn series or Twitter threads, depending on, you know, what channel they're most comfortable in. It could turn into carousels. You could take that slide deck and repurpose it. So I think a lot of people get stuck thinking that they always have to use the entire asset, and B, that it has to be used in its original form. So if it was originally a video, it always has to be a video and it always has to be the whole video. If it was an article, it always has to be an article, long form, and it has to be the whole article, right? And it's like, no, you can take this and repurpose it. I will say, you know, one clarification, you can't, from my perspective, you can't ghostwrite on behalf of someone right out of the gates. They have to either get in a room with you to do an intake or an interview. They have to be writing or speaking or doing podcast interviews or showing up to analyst briefings. They have to be creating that content somewhere in there. The place where the marketers can help is in that repurposing. And so that's where I think the marketers can bring that unique mindset and help augment. It's not having the ideas themselves. It's once the ideas have already been put out there in one form or another, reshaping those or repackaging those for different platforms and different use cases.
I love that you said that, because I have seen a lot of thought leaders who are clearly creating their own content for years. I follow them religiously. I know how they talk and think and act. And then you can tell immediately when they've just started to, you know, clean their hands, outsource it. It's just not the same. So I totally believe what you're saying, and I agree wholeheartedly. And that's, I think, another key takeaway. ghostwriting can only be done with strong collaboration from your internal thought leaders, the people with these unique ideas. And yes, they don't have to write every single post, but you can't just sit down with them for, you know, 5 minutes once a month and just come up with all these posts on behalf of them if you don't have the original fodder. Like, and that could be an hour-long recording, like you said. So thank you for making that point. I think it's a really important one. Ashley, before we hopped on, I asked you a rapid fire series of 10 yes or no questions. I asked you not to think too hard about it, to spend 10 seconds. So literally responding yes, no, down the line. And there were two questions that you said, wow, I haven't really talked about these publicly before. So I'd love to start there. So in terms of thought leadership, is it only for B2B or is it for B2C as well?
This is a hard one because my gut reaction when I saw the question was to say it depends, but that was not the option. That was not the point of the questions. So I landed on the side of saying that no, it is not just for B2B. And then I started thinking, okay, why do I think that? I now have to defend this answer, this unequivocal all caps no. And so I started thinking of examples of B2C companies that have fundamentally helped shift mindsets and shift trends. It's not just that they put out a cool product or that they have smart brand campaigns. And two that I came up with as needing thought leadership are basically in the same space, and it's the sharing economy. So when Uber and Airbnb first came onto the scene, this concept that you're going to get in a car with a stranger and they're going to drive you somewhere. You're going to go stay in a stranger's house, and that's a safe, reasonable thing to do. Or you're going to allow strangers to come into your house, and that's a safe, reasonable thing to do. That is not a small cultural and mindset and behavioral shift that had to happen. Now, of course, like, oh yeah, we have Lyft and we have Uber and oh yeah, right? But the shift, even the shift between, if you think about it, taxis were already doing that. You get in a car with a stranger and they take you somewhere.
Right.
But people didn't think of it that way. And so when Uber came out and when Airbnb came out, they had to do a ton of education in the market about how this is safe, how we think about safety, what it means to be neighborly, what it means to get to know people around the world, what your community is. And so they fundamentally reshaped how we think about engaging with strangers. And now the sharing economy is a thing. The gig economy is a thing. They fundamentally created entire new business models and cultural and community exchanges. And so when you think about B2B, people frequently still think about like, oh yes, we have to educate people about the need. And I'm like, yeah, but in B2C, you have to do the same thing. And this is different than brand campaigns. This is different than corporate social responsibility. This is different than mission statements, right? I debated about whether the stuff that say Nike or Apple do from a, they're frequently held up as strong brands. And I was like, okay, what's the difference between brand and thought leadership? Is what they do, you know, Apple and Nike, is that thought leadership? And from my perspective, it's not. Those are great brand campaigns. They foster trust and rapport with their, you know, they stand for something bigger, right? But a lot of the campaigns that they have run are short-term campaigns. They haven't fundamentally shifted the industry. And I would say that releasing an innovative product doesn't necessarily count as thought leadership, because again, a technology can shift things, but that's a bigger trend that maybe you're existing in versus kind of reshaping how people think about the models or the behaviors within that industry. So it's a, I actually had to think a lot about this of like, did Nike and Apple do it, or are they just really great at branding? Okay. Did Uber and Airbnb do it, or did they just kind of ride a wave that was already there?
Right.
And then how is that different than B2B? Is that truly thought leadership? And so that's why I landed on, I do think it's very important in B2C as well. You know, yes, it is. It tends to be more important in B2B because it tends to be a more complex audience journey, and it tends to be further removed from the end user compared to B2C, where brand can take a higher, you know, more of a lead. But as I thought about it, I was like, nope, B2C needs to keep this in mind too.
I love that you put some extra thought into it. And I totally makes sense. And I will tell everyone listening, when I first answered the question with a split second decision, I was like, no, it's totally B2B. But then when you do sit down to think, then you're like, oh, actually, wait a minute, there is some thought leadership outside of our little bubble of B2B. Yeah. So that's really important context for people to understand when they're trying to wrap their head around this nebulous term of thought leadership, right? So thank you so much for that. The other question, which you thought was kind of interesting, is another kind of conception of thought leadership is that it's somebody really brilliant up there on the stage at an industry conference, or maybe even the TEDx stage. Is the stage the best and ultimate form of thought leadership?
So this was another one where I am highly, highly biased to say yes, 100%, because I personally love public speaking. I like being on the stage. And so for me, if I had, you know, if I had my choice, I would say, oh yeah, you know, thought leadership is ultimately expressed on a stage because that's where I like to be most. But humorously, I think there's a lot of people who would immediately push back and say, oh no, the ultimate expression of thought leadership is writing a book. And so it's interesting because you at the beginning of this call said, oh, Ashley is a thought leader because she has all these frameworks, right? And she's spoken at these conferences, but I haven't written a book. And everybody keeps saying, oh, when are you going to write a book? Oh, you really need to write a book. Oh, you know, to get to the next level, you need to, you know, at some point you're going to have to write a book if you really want to, if you really want to take this to the next level. And so while I would love it if just speaking at industry conferences made me a thought leader, I actually think that it, again, it goes back to that prolific pillar where it's not just about showing up in one place, it's showing up in multiple places in multiple different forms. Because that is an expression of that depth of ideas, that it can stand the stress test of having to be in writing versus a podcast versus on stage versus a long form book. You build that credibility when you're showing up in multiple places. And then obviously having a big profile. Again, as much as I love standing on stage, and I've been on stage in some fairly large rooms, you know, the biggest room I've spoken in is 1,000 people. Versus the impressions and the engagement that I can get on LinkedIn far surpasses that. And so when you start to think about it in terms of the pillars, you realize, okay, it can't actually be the ultimate form is on stage, because then you start to miss out on those prolific and profile pillars, even if you have the depth of ideas and credibility are much stronger when someone can look you in the eye and come up and talk to you afterwards and, you know, oh, you've been vetted. For you to get on the stage, somebody had to invite you to come onto the stage versus LinkedIn. Oh, I just post whatever I want, right? So when you start to look at that, it's really about the balance of the pillars, not necessarily the gatekeeping that happens just on a stage or just in publishing a book.
Interesting. So you feel like you will be a thought leader someday once you get that book deal and the book's published. Ashley is officially a thought leader. No. So what I have to...
I will never call myself a thought leader because no. I feel very stressed. Anytime somebody says that, I'm like, well, according to my own framework, I'm not a thought leader, right? So I don't know if I have a book in me, Erin. Like, I just...
I hear you.
A book is a lot. It's a lot.
And the thing is, so I'm looking at your pillars, of course. I've looked at them several times and how, you know, you can rise in the different pillars. You don't have to be top tier across all four. There are different, you know, tiers. So maybe you're top tier in 1, 2, and 4. And then with prolific, maybe you're in the middle because you don't have that book. You know, that's okay. If you're a marketer trying to elevate yourself or others inside your organization, don't stress them out by being like, oh, you know, you need to be prolific. You need to have a book. You need to have this. Like, baby steps, incremental steps make huge gains. So maybe you start tackling one pillar at a time. Maybe you make some SMART goals for yourself or for people within your organization, right? Do you have any other advice like that for kind of tackling thought leadership through your own framework?
Yeah. So I think the biggest thing is baselining. Obviously, if you're red all the way across the bottom, which basically means, you know, you don't really have credibility, you don't have any depth of ideas, you're not on any channels, and you have zero profile, you're starting, in that case, I would say, okay, first you need to start with the depth of ideas. You need to start looking at your narratives from a conceptual, strategic, and tactical depth, because you can't be prolific, you can't have credibility, you can't grow a profile if you have nothing to share. So that would be where I would say to start. In most cases, the people who even realize there's a framework and start to say, like, there's probably a better way for me to do this, or if they're in a large organization like Atlassian, where we have initiatives around growing that thought leadership. And so they get assigned to work with comms or marketing or, you know, analyst relations or whoever. Usually they're strong and they're making some progress in at least one pillar. And I would say usually that pillar is the credibility pillar. Obviously, we're not running around asking our interns to be our thought leaders. We tend to ask folks who are maybe senior leaders or who have a lot of experience. And so at minimum, they're usually strong in credibility, but I would say run that baseline and then you can start to see where to pinpoint. Again, if you're low and prolific, but you're strong in depth of ideas, then the issue is basically around externalizing those ideas. That's a very different problem than I don't have any ideas. Mm. If you're strong in credibility, but low in profile, that probably means what I tend to see is that you're also probably low in being prolific. And so you just need to start sharing more on LinkedIn. You know, again, I'm highly biased being in the B2B SaaS space to say LinkedIn and starting to pitch for conferences as an example. So some of the pillars tend to have a more direct correlation. But yeah, I would say the step one is start to baseline so that you can understand. And again, I see this too. Some people are low in credibility because they have a sales title or they don't have a good title. They don't have a good, you know, marketers don't have a good title for thought leadership. Okay, that's pretty easily solved by just changing the title in some cases. Mm. So really understanding where you need to focus once you run that baseline, and then you can start to take the steps. I think most people come out of the gates and they're like, I have to have 6 months of content already written. And I'm like, I don't have 6 months of content already written. Like, that's so much content. I agree with you. That is a lot, right? Or they think, oh my gosh, I have to be in the C-suite. No, there are a lot of people who are not in the C-suite who have that credibility, particularly with their audience. Mm. So don't bite off more than you can chew. I agree with you. That incremental steps to get those strong gains, that is an excellent mindset shift to say you don't have to come out and be perfect. You don't have to come out with a fully baked plan. You just need to have some basics to start.
Yeah, I'm latching on a bit to what you said about sales titles and, you know, how easy it is to change someone's title. So something we did at my last company when we launched our categories, we changed people's titles from, you know, account executive to talent optimization advisor because that's less scary. And now they can come out and they can start sharing thoughts about talent optimization, right? Without being like, oh, this person's just trying to sell me something. So So that's a really good point. I see a lot of companies wanting to enable their sales reps to be, you know, sharing the company's strategic narrative and the company's educational materials on LinkedIn, which is, you know, in some form, a bit of thought leadership, even though that individual themselves might not be a thought leader. Do you have any thoughts around that or maybe some tips for trying to enable your sales team to get out there and share the company's thoughts on, you know, and their own thoughts?
Yeah. So I would differentiate a little bit between a thought leadership initiative, a brand awareness initiative or campaign, and kind of that social selling would be, I think, the other pillar. So I actually think if you look at someone like Laura Erdem from Dream Data, she does an excellent job on that social selling piece. You know, she's a sales rep for Dream Data. You know, they're about attribution. And she frequently shows up on behalf of Dream Data. In contrast to someone like me, you pretty much never see me showing up selling what I actually market for Atlassian, right? I do Agile and DevOps. So I'm doing more developer marketing, engineering management marketing, right? I never show up like that on LinkedIn because that's not the audience that I've built. I may actually show up really well from a recruiting perspective on behalf of Atlassian, right? Or some of our brand narratives around unleashing the potential of every team and ways of working. I do have credibility to speak to that, but I still don't show up that way very often. You don't see me talk about Atlassian very often. So if you look, Laura and I would say, are both successful in our goals. She is excellent and is an excellent example of social selling. I don't do social selling because the audience that I've curated doesn't want to buy that, like that, you know, the thing that I actually sell in my day job is not really appropriate for my audience. So I think that the biggest thing when you talk about empowering sales reps to show up, it has to go beyond just putting a webinar link on LinkedIn or putting, you know, we launched a feature. that's not selling. That's advertising. Mm. Pay for that. Like, pay to put that message
out. And no
one
cares. No one wants to see that on their social
media. No one cares. Nobody's going to engage with it, right? Versus, again, if you look at Laura's stuff, asking, how do you think about attribution? Let me show you an actual customer journey and tell you how we got these insights and then tell you what we did to take action on those insights. Whether I buy Dream Data or not, her content is valuable to me because I start to understand how other marketers are thinking about attribution, how other marketers are thinking about the audience journey, how people are tracking those kinds of things. And so I think that that shift into how to think about the problem and understanding the problem space, how to think about the solution and understanding the solution space. Maybe the solution space, maybe the issue is not that you don't have good enough attribution or tracking software. It's that you're fundamentally measuring the wrong things. Or again, this post from Ryan Law yesterday that was making the rounds on Twitter and LinkedIn, talking about the page view paradox. Mm-hmm. And that a lot of the metrics that we optimize for as marketers frustrate our audience. But we don't account for that in our results. We don't account for that sentiment shift or frustration in our results. Oh, they downloaded the ebook. Huzzah, ebook downloads are growing. Okay, but if you lost half the audience by putting something behind a gated form, it doesn't matter that you can track the gated form. You lost half your audience. And right. So those kinds of discussions, when a sales rep can go beyond just that one-way sales broadcast and into educating you about the problem and solution space, that's where the gold is. That's the key. Social selling is a misnomer, unfortunately, because it implies that you're just going to come into people's inboxes and be like, hello, I'm a sales rep and I'm here to sell. It's like, ah, you're so close to me.
Yeah. You're breathing on me in my LinkedIn box. Just stop.
Yes. So that's what I would say. I think it's a fine line. It's a fine line. But there are examples of people who are doing it right.
So let's ask you, like at Atlassian, do you enable your sales team to do social selling, or are you more focused on enabling the thought leaders outside of the sales team?
I think we're going through a shift on this. So Atlassian has grown and has been very successful over the last, 15, 20 years using this land and expand self-serve flywheel model, which basically means we're going to make it as frictionless as possible for you to buy. And that works very well for us and for our products. And so because of that, we haven't had a traditional sales team until recently. And mm-hmm. So I think we're actually going through a mindset shift where in the past, this is the type of content that I work on, we have our Agile microsite, for example, that leans very heavily into Agile practices and enabling Agile teams and Agile practitioners. You can do that with sticky notes. You can do that with a whiteboard. Actually, you can also do it with Jira. May we introduce you to Jira, right? And oh, look, we have a free tier for up to 10 users. So when I talk to you about, prioritizing your backlog for the next sprint, and then I have a tutorial that says, here's how to use backlogs in Jira, it's a lot easier of an on-ramp because, I understand backlogs and sprints. You're right. It would be much easier to do this, especially in a remote world with Jira versus a whiteboard. Oh, and you have a free tier. So you're telling me I can get started today without having to pay? Like, perfect, and so that's a much easier story for us to tell and has worked out really well if we were thinking about a social selling kind of parallel. But we have started to understand that, as sales get more complex, as we have more products and that story is harder to tell, it can be much easier to have a single person who tells that story or works with you in a large organization. In that case, the better way for us to talk about that is not, let me show you how Jira Align can help you get visibility all the way across your portfolio. Like, I don't really care about that at all. Thank you. Versus, let's talk about how you map all of the work that happens at the lowest levels or the front lines of the organization up to the strategic goals at the portfolio level, up to the vision and mission of the company in the long run. And how does that tie in to all of these other objectives? That's a hard problem to solve. That's a big topic to discuss. Mm-hmm. So when you see a rep talking about that, ways of working and those kinds of things on LinkedIn, sure, every so often they'll say, and by the way, this customer used Jira Align to help you do that, or used advanced roadmaps to help you do that, or used Confluence to enable an open culture. But the discussion in that case is more about the ways of working and the goal setting and the visibility than it is about a specific tool. And so I would say we're actually kind of going through a bit of a shift to incorporate, you know, high touch or traditional sales models into how we're doing our content strategy. Because in the past, we were, you know, very focused and continue to be focused on that self-serve flywheel, you know, frictionless, but we've got to incorporate that high touch into our content strategy as well.
So who owns thought leadership then in Atlassian? I know in your last role before you were in product marketing, when you were doing content strategy and you were managing the microsite that you just talked about, who actually kind of owns it across all teams and all companies? Do you have a single owner?
We do not have a single owner. And I think that it has, and I've seen this at other companies as well, where it bounces around. Some people think it belongs in corporate comms. Some people think it belongs in brand. Some people think it belongs in generally the marketing org. So I would say in our case, it is not owned by a single person or a single team. One of the, you know, a blessing and a curse of being such a values-driven company is we are highly collaborative. You know, our play as a team value does show up. And so depending on kind of which channels and which leaders and which narratives we're focused on will kind of depend on who takes the ownership of that particular stream of work or narrative arc. On the flip side of that, this be the change you seek value can sometimes be a double-edged sword where someone's like, I'm just going to go off and be a thought leader. And you're like, come back. Please don't, you know, that's not quite the narrative. Like, let us help you, right?
Yeah.
So, and I think that as we've grown, and especially now that we're remote first with our Team Anywhere mindset and allowing hybrid and people are working not in the office, figuring out how to surface which narratives, how, you know, what is the through line between those narratives? What is that differentiation between more of that thought leadership layer versus a brand narrative versus a campaign narrative versus just a position? You know, we take a lot of strong positions about climate change, for example. That is not necessarily, in my opinion, thought leadership as much as it, or even a brand platform as much as it is, you know, this is just a mission-driven part of how we show up, right? So those, and I think those nuances do matter. It's a lot harder for you to be, you know, a thought leader, again, sharing ideas that fundamentally shift the trends or shape the industry versus just being a strong supporter of other people and brands and companies that have that expertise to shift that mindset. So if you look at that, when you start to break down, you know, that brand platform around ways of working and unleashing the potential of every team, that's a brand narrative. The corporate social responsibility piece around climate change, we lean into working with and supporting the experts in those spaces compared to, you know, some of the thought leadership about, you know, nitty gritty about how teams should work and why they should work that way. And how do you think about team health and how do you drive that forward? Those are kind of three different things, but if you look at how Atlassian shows up, it's like, oh, okay, this all makes sense. We're all speaking from the same playbook. You know, you see it shows up on LinkedIn versus, you know, our brand campaigns or our product campaigns versus what you see our founders or our C-suite out there talking about.
What would you say is a split in terms of, you know, 100% of the pie, and you can divvy it up into SEO content and kind of, you know, help articles and this and that? What kind of percentage of marketing do you think should be attributed or reserved for doing some thought leadership, whether that is on stage, in a book, in the blog? I know a lot of companies that are starting to rename their blog to the thought leadership blog. So it's definitely something companies and marketers are really thinking about. But what do you think is the right percentage?
Oh man, that one I am going to just say it depends, because I think it does depend on the stage of the company, the maturity of the market, and the maturity of the audience. So again, coming from SaaS, and I was at two security startups prior to coming to Atlassian. So this whole conversation about the shift to cloud has been happening for, at this point, almost a decade. And there's still people who like fundamentally are not quite getting that, no, cloud is eating the world, right? When that shift first started to happen, all of the companies that were born in the cloud, cloud native, cloud first, whatever, kind of in that, basically saying like, we're cloud. When they all first came out, they had to do a ton of education and a ton of thought leadership to help make that shift before they could even start getting into the value proposition of their products, right? So they had to do that, that foundational work. Now, a decade later, you know, running around being like, in today's modern times, the cloud has become, it's like, that's not thought leadership. You're just like stating what's already happening in the industry, right? So I think it is very different. I would also say too, if you're in the startup world where you're not going to get your next round of funding and or you're not going to stay alive for another year, if you don't sell product, you don't really have the luxury of talking generically about, you know, how might we do this thing, right? Like you need to get in there and be like, this is the problem. Here's our solution. Here's how you use it and see that benefit. So I think it is highly dependent on the stage and maturity of the market, the company, the audience, and the offerings. So I actually struggle to say what that should be.
No, I mean, that's a great answer. It's an honest answer. And I think that most people listening would agree with you. Last question, since we're coming up on time, what person or company has really inspired you with their thought leadership?
There's a lot. I think I'm actually going to go with this fellow, Scott Berkin. So I love his content. He actually, and it's funny that I say this because you would think I would choose marketing. He actually is in an adjacent discipline. He talks a lot about design thinking, creativity, and problem solving. And the way that he shows up, I've read a couple of his books. I follow him on, you know, Twitter. I've read his blog, and just everything that he does makes me think different. And I read it and I'm like, that, I never thought of that at all, let alone thought of it in this way, but like, this is fascinating. And the way that he is able to connect across different disciplines so that his work is informed by his background, but it is so applicable to other disciplines, that depth of ideas piece is very strong in that, that pillar. So I think I'm going to go with Scott Berkin.
Awesome. Thank you so much, Ashley. If people that are listening want to connect with you, what's the best way for them to find you?
You'll be shocked to hear that I'm going to say LinkedIn.
Surprise.
You know, it's going to be LinkedIn. But no, I am also on Twitter. I am less prolific or credible on Twitter than I am on LinkedIn. But I am on Twitter if people prefer that medium. But yep, LinkedIn is the best place to find me.
Awesome. Well, thank you for coming on. This has been really valuable, and I hope you have a great rest of the day.
Yeah, you too.
Thank you.
The Notorious Thought Leader is brought to you by House of Bold, a content strategy and messaging studio for B2B SaaS companies who need bold content that makes them buckle up, pay attention, and take action. To find out more about House of Bold, head to houseofbold.com. That's H-A-U-S. And then make sure to subscribe to the Notorious Thought Leader in Apple Podcasts, Spotify, and Google Podcasts so you never miss an episode. Thanks for joining me. See you next time.